Yes, I will not be talking about 3.5 keV lines, but if you're interested, I'm happy to talk about it at lunch. So instead today, I wanted to talk about how we can use data, in particular at radio and X-ray frequencies, as something very complementary to gamma ray probes of dark matter annihilation and decay. And before I get into my talk, I want to give credit where credit is due. All of the work that I'm going to be talking about is the work of my current graduate student, Alex McDaniel, and my former graduate student, Emma Storm, who's now a postdoc at GRAPPA. Okay, so out of dark matter annihilation, in typical wind dark matter models in general, also potentially dark matter decay, you can get a range of products that you might be able to see. So obviously, we've spent a lot of effort looking in the gamma ray, because from neutral pion decay or in final state radiation, you can get gamma ray photons. But complementary to that, you also get relativistic charged particles. So you get electrons and positrons, you get neutrinos, you get antiparticles, so other sources that you can look for. So generically, this leads to a broad spectrum of emission that you can try to find. So gamma ray, of course, from either neutral pion decay or direct production. But because you produce these relativistic charged particles, you also expect to see inverse Compton scattering of, for sure, the cosmic microwave background. But if you're producing these charged particles in the center of a galaxy, also inverse Compton scattering of, for example, starlight. And that generically comes out in the X-ray, hard X-ray regime. In addition, if you have dark matter annihilation in regions where there is a magnetic field, center of galaxies, clusters of galaxies, then you expect synchrotron emission in radio. So this leads to more than one probe that you can use to look for signals from dark matter, or in the case that you see an anomalous signature, to try to confirm or refute a dark matter origin. Okay, so taking a step back, targets for dark matter searches. There are many places that we can think of looking. They have their pluses and minuses. So the galactic center we heard a lot about this morning, dwarf galaxies, external galaxies, clusters of galaxies, and then if you have an all-sky survey or a large enough field of view, diffuse emission from the Milky Way halo or extragalactic dark matter. Now, depending on your particle physics model, one or the other of these may be better or worse. So some considerations of what are good targets is obviously the J factor. But going into that is also, you know, the uncertainty. How well do I know the J factor? What's the uncertainty in the dark matter profile, the potential substructure boost? You know, instrumental things like my field of view also come into play there. And then there's, the astrophysical background you might need to contend with. So as was already stated, you know, generically, the galactic center should be our brightest dark matter source, but it is very bright in astrophysical backgrounds at all wavelengths. So targets like dwarf galaxies, clusters of galaxies, lie in regions, in particular for gamma ray signals, of very low background, so they're cleaner. Now, for what I'm going to talk about, where we're concerned with secondary emission, like inverse Compton or synchrotron, there's additional astrophysics that comes into play, including particle diffusion. If your particles escape your system before radiating, that's no good. You're not going to see anything. And for example, for synchrotron, the level of the magnetic field. So I won't just talk about clusters, but in general, one of the cleanest targets when thinking about these secondary emissions are clusters of galaxies, for the reason that they do trap these relativistic particles for long enough for them to radiate. So it simplifies the modeling and some of the uncertainty in the modeling. Okay, so before moving on, I do want to point out what I think is incredibly fortunate for us, which is that different targets, if you think about J factors, different targets have roughly similar predicted emission, right? So, you know, if we see an excess in the galactic center, obviously there's some wiggle room in those uncertainties on J factors, right? But we see an excess in the galactic center, we can say, hey, I would expect to see something from dwarfs. It's at least within reach that, you know, we can confirm or refute dark matter origins of anomalous signals, because we happen to have lots of different targets that come out to have generally similar expected emission. There's also this expected multi-frequency emission that we can use as another handle. So I'll get to this at the end of the talk, but so for example, you see a signal in gamma ray. The spectrum I'm showing here, this is the gamma ray detection of Andromeda by Fermi. And if you want that to be a dark matter signal, then there is going to be a corresponding, for example, radio synchrotron emission that you expect to see. And if that expected signal overproduces the observed radio emission, then that puts tension on your dark matter interpretation. So we have lots of different ways of testing and then hopefully eventually confirming a signal from dark matter. Okay, so I already kind of said this, but so my first bit of my talk is going to be looking specifically at multi-wavelength signatures from clusters of galaxies. So the nice thing here in terms of thinking about secondary radiation is that if you look at the time scale for relativistic particles to these electrons and positrons that you would produce in dark matter annihilation to escape from the cluster, clusters are large, that time scale is much longer than the time scale to radiate through inverse Compton or synchrotron. So you're going to radiate before you escape. So that means that essentially you will expect to see emission from all, you know, all of these electrons, positrons that get produced through, say, dark matter annihilation or decay in the cluster. In terms of the radio, they also have large-scale magnetic fields, so we would expect to see some of the synchrotron signal. So I only have one slide on X-ray. So one of these multi-wavelength probes that I mentioned was the inverse Compton emission, and this is just a slide to show for a variety of dark matter annihilation models that, you know, along with your Pinot decay gamma rays, you expect an inverse Compton signal that peaks roughly in the hard X-ray. So we looked at, you know, what could we say with existing and future instruments, and unfortunately, the sensitivity is not competitive yet. You could, however, build, if you launched an X-ray telescope in a low enough background region, you could potentially have competitive constraints coming out of the X-ray, but we're not there right now. Now, this, of course, does not mean that X-rays are not of interest for other dark matter candidates like the steroneutrino, which was just talked about. Obviously, there are other reasons we like X-ray for dark matter searches. Okay, now, so what I'm going to spend most of the rest of the time talking about is radio and the potential for using radio observations to probe dark matter models. So as I said, you know, dark matter annihilation or decay producing high energy electrons and positrons, you would expect synchrotron emission. Now, some clusters of galaxies, roughly a third of them, do have detected diffuse radio emission. We don't think this is dark matter. I mean, this was actually an attempt to fit the radio signal from COMA as dark matter, but there are perfectly reasonable reasons that we think there's shock-accelerated cosmic rays in clusters that produce diffuse radio emission. So that is a definite background. However, there are many clusters, actually most of them so far at our sensitivities, that do not have detected radio emission. And those non-detections can be interesting. These are a couple plots from a paper. This was really kind of a pilot proof of concept study where we looked for existing upper limits on radio emission from local clusters of galaxies and use those to derive limits on dark matter annihilation. So this is a non-detection. This is actually there is a detected radio mini halo in a Fucus, but even if you take the detected emission as an upper limit, you still get pretty strong constraints. So this is NFW only, no substructure, totally conservative. Obviously, these are different annihilation final states. So obviously for things like mu plus, mu minus, tau plus, tau minus, the leptonic final states, you get the strongest constraints out of this. But you can see, you know, even for just what we could find in the literature, that you're getting down towards thermal cross sections, even with a conservative density profile at low masses. And this is just an example of the radio constraints compared to the best Fermi individual cluster Fermi constraints from Fornax. So you can see we're doing a factor of a few better. I also show the uncertainty in the constraints coming from magnetic field uncertainty and cluster mass uncertainty. Magnetic field is the dark gray and the mass is the light gray. So, you know, this isn't completely fair, because obviously the cluster limits are not, for annihilation, are not the strongest limits, period, coming out of Fermi. You can certainly do better by stacking, and the dwarfs are stronger than this. But it does show you, I think, already with existing data, the potential for radio. So what we looked at next then was, you know, in radio, we have new facilities that have recently come online or are being built up. We have the square kilometer array to look forward to. So there are going to be very large gains in radio in the near future, in particular, both from new capabilities at lower frequencies, as well as increased sensitivity at, you know, your more typical gigahertz frequencies from the square kilometer array, pathfinders, and eventually SKA. So this is just an example of, these are normalized to the best constraints that I had, that we had from the previous slide, for different dark matter annihilation to BB bar for different dark matter masses. So, you know, TeV and down to 10 GeV. And for comparison, here's the LOFAR frequency range, and here's the OSCOP frequency range. And you can see there's good complementarity. So as I'll show in a second, there's also good sensitivity. But here, you know, LOFAR is will be quite sensitive to, you know, lower masses, whereas OSCOP and eventually SKA to higher masses. Okay, so we did the exercise of trying to make some predictions for how well could you do. So this is a busy plot. I will just go through it. So what we did was take, let's say I have a coma mass cluster that I don't detect. If you detect some, that's fine. You're free to pick whatever your best candidate cluster is, as long as you're not seeing it. And we looked first just at this LOFAR Tier 1 survey. So this is a planned full northern sky survey. So think wide area, shallow. And these are the solid lines and the dashed lines here. Compared to the black is the Fermi dwarfs. Now, I picked the best possible case here. This is annihilation to mu plus mu minus. I will show BB bar and tau plus tau minus on the next slide. So you can see this looks great. We're doing really well. So a few things to take away. Okay, so the blue versus the green are two different magnetic field models. The solid lines versus the dashed lines are different redshifts. So the solid lines are low redshift, like the coma cluster, whereas the dashed lines are if you put a cluster up at a redshift of 0.5. So you can see that for this final state, we're definitely beating the Fermi dwarf constraints over a large mass range. But another thing I want you to take away from this is that this expected signal is not, in particular, in the LOFAR frequency range, is not supermagnetic field dependent. It's also not very redshift dependent. And that's just because, you know, as you go to higher redshift, they're smaller and you're adding up a lot less noise. And so your sensitivity doesn't decrease in the way you might expect. So, you know, while there are astrophysical reasons why clusters might light up in radio, I think there's some hope, if it was dark matter, of understanding that, because if, you know, you get a dark matter signal from one cluster, you should get a dark matter signal from many clusters. And it's not going to scale in the same way that cosmic ray, you know, shock, recent merger kind of radio emission is going to scale. And it gives you a lot of clusters over a large redshift range that you can do this kind of analysis for. Okay, so here's the slightly, you know, here's the other final state. So this is annihilation to BB bar, this is annihilation to taus, and you can see that for this shallow Tier 1 survey, same lines here, we're kind of getting down to the Fermi dwarfs at around 10 GeV, but just kind of matching. But again, you know, this isn't like, this is the all sky, well, all northern sky survey. So for something like a medium deep planned Tier 2 LOFAR survey, you could get down to this red line. And this is not even like I picked my best candidate cluster to like point at and observe. Now, to be fair, to actually get down to the sensitivity, we're going to have to beat down on the confusion limit. It's not that super easy to get your noise down to this level. But it does show the potential, I think. And, you know, we haven't redone these this analysis for SKA, but the potential of radio observations as being as having a sensitivity that can match or beat all of the current gamma ray limits. And another thing to point out is that, again, there's this complementarity. So again, this green line is just that shallow tier one survey and the Fermi dwarfs. And here's where that the galactic center excess sits. So, you know, again, it's an it gives you the possibility of an independent check. Okay, so I need to go a little bit faster. So that's clusters. Now, if you want to go beyond clusters and talk about other dark matter targets, like dwarf galaxies, then you need to do a bit better job on the astrophysics. I don't do Twitter, so I don't have a Twitter thing up here, but I am going to advertise a GitHub page. So my students developed this tool, RxDMFit, that's for radio X-ray dark matter fitting. It's publicly available, and what this does is it takes, you know, Dark Susie as an input, and then, so you can choose your particle model, and then given the charged particle spectrum that, that gives you, it models the diffusion of particles in your system, all of the relevant radiative energy losses, magnetic fields. It comes with many, many user-chosen knobs that you can tweak for, you know, the size of your signal, the magnetic field and its profile, dark matter density, diffusion parameters, allowing you to model a wider range of potential systems. So very quick, this is just a couple of examples. So you can specify the diffusion coefficient, and there's a couple options for the energy scaling. So these are examples of, so for clusters, this is a zoom in. So you put in diffusion versus no spatial diffusion, you get an effect of like 1 to 2% in clusters. In a galaxy scale system, it's a little more significant. It's very important if you want to go to a dwarf scale system. So this is just cranking up the diffusion coefficient. Magnetic fields, and you can play around with both the central magnetic field and its radial scaling, allowing you to model a wide variety of systems. So the last thing I'll talk about is the specific application of this tool to looking at Andromeda. So there is a gamma ray detection of Andromeda. It's extended by Fermi. And it doesn't appear, the spatial distribution doesn't appear to trace well gas or star formation in the galaxy. So there's various possibilities for this signal, but you know, one possibility is a likening to the galactic center excess in terms of the possibility that it might be dark matter. So we decided to take a look at this, in particular comparing to the radio data from Andromeda, but just first on the gamma ray alone. So the purple points here, this is the Fermi spectrum. The dashed lines here are dark matter models that fit well the GEV excess in the galactic center. And the solid lines are, you know, our best fit model. So blue is BB bar, green is democratic BB bar and taus. And the first thing to see is that the galactic center models don't fit well the Andromeda data. The Andromeda signal is softer. It prefers lower masses in general. Second thing is, you know, if you take the observations and turn this into a cross-section versus mass, this is, you know, tuning the knob of the inner slope, so in your generalized NFW. And so if you want to be, especially now we're at lower preferred masses, if you want to be consistent with the dwarf constraints, then you need, you know, fairly steep profiles. So this is just, you know, where our best fits would be for different gamma. And here's the galactic center constraint, or the galactic center fits. Okay, so, but as I said previously, you know, you see this gamma ray signal, obviously there's a magnetic field in Andromeda, and so you can ask, okay, if that's dark matter, let me predict what radio emission I think I would see. And generically, so the red points are actual radio observations for the core of Andromeda, and generically you overproduce the radio emission. Now, you might ask, okay, but there's a lot of astrophysics, and what happens if I tweak my astrophysics? So you can vary the magnetic field, but even cranking down the magnetic field to what would be quite low for a central galactic field, we're still in tension. So that doesn't seem to alleviate the tension. Now, if you crank up diffusion, you can evade these radio points. So, you know, kind of nominal Milky Way values of the diffusion coefficient are the blue, which is intention, but if you crank it up to like more like the upper limit on what we might have in the Milky Way to the green, then you can make this dark matter interpretation consistent. Okay, so I'm going to stop there. I don't tweet, but I did try to at least put a very short summary at the top, which is that the use of multiple probes and wavelengths will really be critical to identifying and understanding a dark matter signal. That wasn't very funny, so I added radio rules. I thought about putting Fermi rules, but I actually think Fermi is really spectacular, so I couldn't say that. My slightly longer version of my conclusions is that I think there are some opportunities with upcoming radio facilities and surveys in terms of looking at dark matter. But, you know, note that secondary signals require understanding extra systematics associated with astrophysical conditions, and so if you want to do that, please use our tool. And I'm done.
Questions?
So with regard to the diffusion coefficient and the magnetic field that you were playing with to model Andromeda, the diffusion coefficient in our galaxy is degenerate with the height of the halo, I guess you know that.
Mm-hmm.
Because you infer it from the ratio of secondary to primary nuclei, like boron to carbon, so the volume in which they're diffusing matters. So in fact, you could actually consider not just the diffusion coefficient per se, but the ratio of the diffusion coefficient to the height of the halo. That's what's actually measured.
Okay.
And you can vary each of them in, you know, individually so as to maintain the same ratio.
Okay. Yeah. So I guess I don't know that in detail, but so those are degenerate with each other in that sense. Okay.
What you actually measure is boron to carbon or, you know, whatever it is in cosmic rays. The second thing is the magnetic field. The value that we actually measure in our galaxy from parallel rotation and so on is like 2 to 3 microgauss,
mm-hmm.
whereas what you infer from the strength of the synchrotron emission is more like 7-8 microgauss.
Mm-hmm.
This mismatch, this issue has been there for years. It's very likely because the magnetic field and the cosmic ray electrons are correlated. Where you compress the field, you compress the electrons with it. So their density goes up, their energies go up, and so the synchrotron emission depends on the correlated energy and density.
Yeah, so what I should say that all of the magnetic field values I put up are for like at the center, and then it drops off radially. So our average fields are actually not that high in most cases. The average fields would be consistent with the numbers that you just said. But again, it's a knob you can tweak. So in particular in Andromeda, the most conservative thing we put in was a central field of 5 microgauss, which the average field then is pretty low, and that was still in tension with the radio
that
point.
That was still in tension.
It was still in tension, yeah. Yep.
That's interesting. Okay, thanks.
Yep. This one, yep. And so in terms of diffusion coefficient, this is 3 times 10 to the 29. This is 3 times 10 to the 28.
So that, as you said, is the median value for our galaxy.
Yeah. So you can crank this. I mean, I think this isn't an unreasonable value. It's just on the high side, right?
So the work on the galaxy clusters is really interesting. Many galaxy clusters are known to produce radio halos, which are mm-hmm. probably cosmic ray induced. So could you just talk a little bit more about how to distinguish these signals, either by spectra or the spatial morphology of the signal, and if that's included in the modeling at all for the sensitivity?
Yeah, so you have a few different handles. So first of all, I mean, in terms of constraints, you're free to pick any cluster you want that doesn't have the radio halo. But yeah, a more interesting question, because we'd actually like to understand what dark matter is when you see something, how do you distinguish? So there's a couple handles that you have. I think given what we've found, a good one is just going to be the scaling from cluster to cluster, right? So for the cosmic ray ones, that We know there's a good correlation with recent merger history and those lighting up where, you know, there's a lot of clusters we've seen from the Fermi stacking, right? There's a lot of nearby clusters that have vaguely similar J factors, and then they should all show up in radio where you wouldn't necessarily see the cosmic rays. And the spectrum, of course, I mean, it's going to be, if it's dark matter, it's the same particle, so you would see a similar spectrum. It depends on the mass, you know, distinguishing a dark matter spectrum per se from a cosmic ray spectrum kind of depends on the mass, like how well you can distinguish those. But obviously, you would expect a consistent spectrum from all clusters if it's dark matter. The spatial profile, I think, is another potential handle, but again, you know, it's how, you know, you need to not just detect it, but you need to detect it well enough that you can trace out very confidently but yeah, so there's various things that you could try. I think the very first thing would be that, like, if it's dark matter, like, all of the clusters should be lighting up in radio, where I wouldn't expect that for cosmic rays.
Any more questions? I actually had a question about Andromeda. So
okay.
In your interpretation, you're assuming that the entirety of the gamma ray signal that is measured originates from dark matter.
Sure, which it doesn't need to, yes, of course.
And then if you can, you have some room there to assign maybe part of that emission, say diffuse emissions or say pulsars or something like that, and your dark matter signal will go down.
For sure.
And then you can evade the...
Yeah, use. And actually what we're working on now on a follow-up paper, this is a dark matter conference, so I didn't show anything, on like trying to fit the gamma ray and radio together as cosmic ray signals. I mean, you can already see that, like, you have a different shape of the spectrum here, right, in the radio than in the gamma ray also. So, but yeah, right. Obviously, this doesn't all have to be be dark matter.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. So unless there are any more questions or comments, we can wrap it up. Let's thank Tesla and then let's just a reminder then that the afternoon today is free. There are no more talks. Also, there is going to be a seminar in this room starting at 2 p.m. So if you leave your bags, be aware that there will be people here at 2 p.m. It might not be easy to get in here, unless you want to attend the seminar, which of course you're welcome to. Yes, we were asked to remove that. But I'm assuming the seminar is open to everybody.
Yes,
people are welcome.
Yeah.